Okay? You just got to be careful because I'm feeling good, you see. And on these at these moments, one feels that one is going to solve all of ones. Right? Do you think one day it's all going to be solved? All the messes are going to be cleared up and they're going to get it all straightened out. The right guy's going to get in and all the troubles are going to be over. Your knee is going to stop hurting. And it's all going to straighten out. It's all going to work out. So, there was a guy named, what was his name? Leonard Gordian. Leonard Gordian, who invented this knot. It was kind of a slip knot. And they call it Leonard Gordian slip knot, I remember. And Leonard Gordian had invented a slip knot, which, well, it was a pretty hard knot to work, and it was a hard knot to tie, and an even harder knot to untie. And there was a myth that sprang up around the town where he did this, which was Augusta, Maine. And the myth said that no one could untie Gordian's knot, Leonard Gordian's knot, or Lenny, as he was known to all the gang around Bangor, the pool room where he hung out and got his start. Moved to Augusta. There was a lot of stuff going on there. And he figured one day in the dark of the moon that, hello there, Prometheus. Hi. Hello. Sit down. That's Harold Prometheus. How are you? This is Harold Monolith here, and I'll be here for a while. And it's a fine thing, you think about it. it's all right, you know. I mean, it's a fine thing. We're all here. We're the class of 1963, all of us here. It's hard to believe it, but one day all of us will be gone. We will be history. And we're here now, though. You see, we've got the scene taped now. We've got the stage for a while here. The class of 63. I'd love to have a class photo. And under each photo in the giant class photo, under each name, there has to be the class prediction. 2.5 billion of them. You know, and way down at the end, there are the Eskimos standing there, sort of looking fat, looking out of their furs. And way over at the other end, there's a bunch of Indonesians. And in the middle, there's a couple of, yeah, no, there we are, and all of us. And I'm sorry, it's early in the morning. You know, actually, it's not early in the morning. It's kind of late in a way. No. Since it's that time of night, it's earlier than you think, friend. Oh no, you've got a lot more time to go. Don't worry about it. I would not fool around. I would not try to finish that play. You got a lot of time. A lot of time. You're going to live forever. Right now, there's a guy working in the laboratory, and he's working on the serum. Everybody feels, you know, that just about the time he's about to expire, the door will slam open. Hold it, doctor! We just worked out the serum! Hold it! We got the serum! Here, help! And they rush up, and you're lying there, and you're whipping out your last words, and they have the thing there, the long glass needle. They stick it in there, and 5 seconds later, you're 15 years old. Your knee is fixed, and you jump up, and you run out, and you're all ready to start it all over again, only better this time, of course. Only better this time. Yeah, that's one of the great American myths, that if you had it to do over again, that's the great myth. Listen, if you had it to do over again, you'd be worse. You would louse up even worse, because the second time, you'd be nervous. You see, the first time, it takes you at least 20 years to become nervous, and then you can start lousing up. But the second time around, you'd start being nervous about the first 5 minutes because you know what's in ahead. You know, you start trying to really work on fielding ground balls and stuff like that. Well, you know, kitty plays around. You know, that's one of the great myths, isn't it, though? If you had it to do over again, how great you'd be, all the things you'd do. And you think you failed as a dentist, you'd be, oh boy, you have no idea how you would fail if you had become an anthropologist. Oh, talk about flops, oh boy. Nothing is worse than an unsuccessful scientist who is in a creative field where deep thinking is necessary, and he is neither creative nor deep thinking. He's just very good with log tables, that's about it. I think we ought to sing a little anthem here. Let's get the gang all together now, gang. She's got eyes of blue. I never cared for eyes of blue, but she's got eyes of blue, and that's my weakness now. She's got dimpled cheeks. I never cared for dimpled cheeks, and she's got dimpled cheeks, and that's my weakness now. Oh, me. Oh, me. Oh, me. Oh, me. That's terrible. I don't, madam, I do not blame you for getting as mad as you are. How, just realize how mad I get when I try so hard to be serious. I try so hard to be a deep thinker. I try so hard to be Eric Severide, and what do I turn out being, for crying out loud? You realize that I came within a hair of being Johnny Carson? No, I mean, if you can be really serious about those tap dancers. I can't. Gee, it takes a great deal of talent, as well as you have to be made of almost complete brass to be able to look in Genevieve's eyes and say, you know, you're very talented, a very talented girl.
Fox, baby fox,
right there.
Fox, baby fox.
Oh, wow, 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 wow.
She likes engagement rings.
All right, now, gang. That's enough. That's enough. You have my Sinister Oriental music in there, Eddie. Just throw it on. Sinister Oriental. Anyone, you know. Come on. Sinister Oriental music. Sinister Oriental music. There are great things afoot. And, doing. For a special announcement, for a special tour for available Chinese bachelor playboy. Special tour announced in Chinese American Times. Chinese bachelor playboy tour to Far East. Personally conducted by bachelor playboy tour conductor. Leaving New York City very shortly for Far East. Complete cost $1,350. All fun, transportation, hotel meals, and whoopee included. Chinese bachelor playboy. Now all sign up for a big tour to Far East. Make scene in Hong Kong, Las Vegas, San Francisco, Honolulu, Tokyo, Kyoto, Taiwan. Swing all the way, man. I think that's great. Did you realize, you know, that one of the new big things in the tour world is, don't you know that one of the things is what they call a specialized tour, where, you have an art lover's tour where everybody goes and looks at art for a couple of weeks, and then there's the cinema tour now where you go to all the festivals. Oh, yes, that's a real hang-up. And then there's the religious tour where you go to all the cathedrals. And there's even a golfing tour now. Oh, yeah, you go and you play on all the great golf courses of Europe. Where do you go? St. Andrews. You go, yeah, oh, sure, very, very big thing, these specialized tours. Well, I can think of a lot of great tours. Junkies tour, you know. It says, man, if you've really... Beirut, they cover all kinds of places like Marrakesh. Spend 3 nights in an awful, terrible, rotten, smoky opium den in Damascus, and all the things you've dreamed of down on McDougal Street now come true. Purple dream of hashish. Well, what a wonderful swinging night. Well, I can think of a lot of tours. Now, finally, the Chinese Bachelor Playboy Tour to the Far East. Now, that does not... don't you know there are plenty of Chinese Bachelor Playboys running around? Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, now there is one tour that they're organizing is a tour. It's called the Hard Shell Methodist Tour for the guys who want to get away for 2 weeks and really make the scene. And oh yeah, and you can it's go visit the flesh pots of Europe purely as a man who wants to study sin firsthand, so that he can understand goodness better. That's the way I think you have to look at it that way. Speaking of goodness, let's play the commercial here before we do anything else. Go ahead, hit the commercial, Eddie. There. And
now, ladies and gentlemen, Volvo will demonstrate the beauty of word-of-mouth advertising. Volvo out-accelerates every other popular price compact in every speed range. Gets over 25 miles to the gallon like the little economy cars. Is virtually indestructible. See the yellow pages for the dealer nearest you.
Volvo runs away from every car on the road.
Gee, that's
a real man.
Gets over
35 miles to the gallon like the little economy cars and is indestructible. Your dealer is in the phone book.
Volvo will beat any car on the road in any gear. Gets over 45 miles to the gallon, and you can't hurt it. Phone your dealer.
Volvo is the fastest car ever made. You don't have to put gas in it, and it won't scratch up.
Oh, boy.
Your dealer will phone you.
As we said, ladies and gentlemen, Volvo runs away from every other popular price compact in every speed range. Gets over 25 miles to the gallon like the little economy cars, is virtually indestructible. See the yellow pages for the dealer nearest you.
That's a real goer. That's a wild announcer there, but that's a nice car in spite of it. It really is. The Volvo is a... is, you know, it's a... Oh, we have here things. It says Nemeth Motors, 153-19 Hillside Avenue, Jamaica, Queens. That's the Volvo dealer. And we're here. Yeah, speaking of making the scene in all possible directions, there was a little news note. Of course, today we're worshiping ourselves more than ever, more than we've ever done it before in the past. And as we worship ourselves, we can't figure out many good reasons why. Oh, speaking of self, oh, this is WOR AM and FM New York, this self-worship station. And we'll be here until midnight or so. But we have a lot of trouble, you know, when we're worshiping ourselves, because we know that we have large, fat feet of clay, very big, fat feet of clay. And when we were worshiping other gods, they never have feet of clay. Now that we're worshiping in our own shrine, we know that, you know, we melt in the rain, and we have a lot of problems that way. So we have to concentrate on other things instead of morality, things like that. Old outmoded ideas, you know, like codes of behavior, you know, all those things. We have to do other things, and it takes many forms. It takes so many forms that sometimes you got to keep your eyes well peeled to observe. I just couldn't help but imagine that image of this eye peeler being put on the market for people who want to have clean, incisive inner vision. I'm sorry. And you have a periscope, you see. If you're one of those people who have trouble being introspective, have you ever read all the introspective novels, you know, where the people are constantly asking themselves questions and talking to themselves, and they're constantly reacting to situations, and you have trouble doing that. You just walk around, you know, stuff hits you on the head, and you drink a malt, and you fall down, you eat a hamburger, and you holler at somebody. You don't ever have it. If you have trouble with that, can you imagine a little periscope that is set up so that you can look into your soul? For those guys who have trouble doing it, you know, you set it on top of your head, you know, strap it around your ears, and then it looks inside, and you turn it on. It's all done electronic, and it'll be an electronic, what they call introspectroscope. That's better. An electronic transistorized introspectroscope. Now brought to you by RCA, another great movement forward in the world of electronics. Examine your soul. Have a conscience. Be bug. Try our new... You find that nothing ruffles the placid surface of your dull life. You find that you live a life of almost total non-conflict. Wouldn't you like to be torn asunder like Geraldine Page is every night in the second act of that great O'Neill play? Yes, the new electronic life dramatizer, which trims and cuts all the fat away from your life, you know, the fat flab, cuts it all away and reduces it to the bone, the hard iron sinew of existence. I had a saying here. Yeah, speaking of the hard sinew of existence, there's a little note came in. Has to be done in Texas accent. A retired industrialist who sold out his electronics business 5 months ago bought a $1 million Sabreliner airplane right over the counter this past week. I'll be damned. Arthur D. Knapp, 71, purchased the 600-mile-an-hour jet aircraft at the convention here in Houston of the National Business Aircraft Association. from Jackson, Michigan, Mr. Knapp surprised 1,000 delegates to the convention by simply poking his finger at the large twin jet 600-mile-an-hour model and said, "I want that." Bill Remmert, president of the distributing firm that distributes the airplane, quickly handed it over to him before he changed his mind. The plane is manufactured by North American Aviation, Inc. 71, he bought it. Well, nothing wrong with that, folks. No, don't look at me like it's okay. It's perfectly all right. Now, he's not the only guy that's working on his own little scene. Do you ever read the New York Times? They're the only newspaper I see that does it regularly. They have a patents column, tells all the new things that are patented. There's some wild stuff going on there. And one of the greatest wild patents I've seen in connection with the in-the-dotage area of man's behavior pattern, a former minor league ball player has invented a baseball bat that is square in cross-section. He says the round bat causes just too many foul balls. And he predicts the flat surface of his invention will bring remarkable improvement to the average batter's hitting accuracy. Now, all he's got to do is to invent a square ball that doesn't bounce crooked. You just hit it square there, and it'll go right away. The inventor, of course, is Frank R. Salinger of Forty Fort, P.A., now 78, and retired. Mr. Salinger reports that his bat has been received enthusiastically by youngsters in Mississippi, where he spends his vacations. He has conferred with Little League officials at their national headquarters in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, about optional use of the square bat. He says that he will be more than happy to send them 200 on trial. I can see these poor guys at the national headquarters trying to get rid of them. Well, fellas, you're going to have 200 square bats on your hand very shortly. It'll be very nice in those long winter evenings. Just saw them up. They fit just right. It'll work with the andirons there. You know, well, on the subject of the square bat, though, and the old guy buying the 600-mile-an-hour Sabre jet, that every one of us in a kind of way, it's funny how we look upon this as a nutty behavior. That guy doing the thing with the square bat represents something, though, in our time. Even the old duffers are doing it. Everything is to be made easier, thereby completely missing the point of what you're doing. In short, if you could somehow just think, Mr. Salinger, how much easier basketball would be if the baskets were only 3 feet off the ground and they were 17 feet in diameter. You know, just drop it in, you know, no problem there. It would make things a lot easier, and a lot of rotten basketball players would become good basketball players. And all the way down the line, this is the tenor of modern life. We assume that because we make a car automatic, we have made a lot of drivers. No. We have made it possible for a lot of non-drivers to kill a lot of people, is exactly what we have done. And you know, that is a point that many a cab driver will tell you. He'll say that the minute they brought all the automatic equipment out, they put a lot of people in the seat who should never be driving cars. Who have no mechanical aptitude and no knowledge at all of the machine and don't even know they're in a machine. They just sit in there and make it go. It's automatic, and then about 5 minutes later, boom, and that's it. But this is part of the automatic life of our time. Of course, this, again, relates to what could be called the total triumph of democracy, where people with no talent get bugged because they're prevented from doing things that people with talent can do. You know, Ed? It's a lot of guys who probably get mad because they can't kick a football. Well, now, I assume that there is a guy working with very seriously in his basement with a little motor-driven football that has little propellers on each end, and any guy who can't pass, all he has to do is hold this little football and point it at the end, flip the switch, and away it goes. Self-propelling football that flies in a perfect spiral every time and doesn't even have an arch. Sure, that's the kind of nuttiness we're having. And everywhere you look now, guys are being bothered by the fact that this is patently not true, of course. The talent has become a real thing that people are mad at. It goes against one of the very basic principles in American life, that all men are created equal. Well, of course, this used to mean politically. It meant a lot of other ways. But now people are interpreting it as mean that all men are created with the same amount of talent. You're going to mean to tell me I can't paint that? How? What is this paint? Give me the paints. I'll paint you one. And what's so funny, 10 minutes later, he's in the Museum of Modern Art. It's an intriguing problem. Of course, I think it all relates to the fact that it's like the theater. That people who used to go to the theater were people who were certainly up to a certain point literate. They were literate people. They had an interest in the theater, and they had some knowledge of it, and certainly some knowledge of the world. But today, the people who are going to the theater are generally people who, but for the fact that the old man has made some dough, would be at home watching soap opera on television. But, you see, they've got the same mentality, the same ideas, and the same kind of drama they want. And so now that drama is appearing on Broadway. Most of our top dramas, other than the English, incidentally, are soap opera dramas, pretty much. Hardly ever do we take on any kind of social issue or issue of man involved in his world. We take on boy versus girl, man versus woman, which is pure, unadulterated soap opera. And then, have you noticed that many of the painters? This is another thing a few years ago, when people would go in to buy paintings, people who bought paintings were special people. They knew something generally about painting. They knew something about. They had taste and discretion. They had ideas. They also had standards. Well, now today, everybody wants an original. That word you hear all the time. What we ought to have, Mabel, over the sofa there is we ought to get an original oil painting. I like original oil paintings there. Did you know Elmer bought one last week? Original oil painting. Got this big sailboat. The idea of an original oil painting, of course, is a very big thing now with a lot of slobs. Now, many people feel that is bringing art into people's houses. Don't you get to forget it. Not a bit of it. These people are still anti-art. And so what happens is that there has sprung up a large number of painters who paint the things that these slobs are familiar with and will accept, like Dick Tracy. You paint a great big oil painting of Dick Tracy or a large oil painting of a beer can. Well, now, that is very familiar material to the slob that goes in there, and he warms it. He identifies with it, and it becomes art. The only difference is that he used to just simply buy a can of Ballantine for 23 cents, but now he buys a picture of a can of Ballantine for $1,450. He hangs it up there. It's a very intriguing thing. A lot of people say, well, no, we're art is coming into contact with people. No, I disagree with you there. I say that art has come down to people. That art used to sort of be up here. When you say art, the term fine art no longer exists really in the language, and so we have this great body of stuff, like a giant hamburger, big concrete hamburger. Now that makes a guy feel a lot better who was always bugged by Henry Moore. Couldn't figure out why, he couldn't really Jacques Lipchitz. He couldn't figure out that stuff, and Rodin was kind of bumpy. He couldn't figure out all those bumpy things there. So now you give him a great big concrete hamburger, painted, by the way, in hamburger colors. That's a very good sculpture there. I want that in the backyard, right next to the barbecue. That's very good. Big hamburger there, and and so what's happening is probably the final victory of democracy, I suppose you might say. So there was a time when movies, I'll take like the idea of movies, there was a time when movies, as exemplified by all sorts of great directors of the past, great Russian directors, German directors of the 20s, a lot of American directors of the 30s, Preston Sturges, a lot of great directors, they dealt quite intellectually in many cases with very complex social and aesthetic problems. Today you dealt only with one thing. Guess what it is? And it's spelled with just three simple little letters. Now, it's become more and more, that's called art. That's just become a very major art. Well, now, that's the same stuff that the slob was digging years ago. Three little letters. He was digging it down in the basement of the Legion Hall. And now they brought it upstairs, and it's become a very big thing. Now, you have not brought the public up to this. You've brought art down to him. It's a tricky thing. One thing you'll find, too, that all the critics are very afraid to say anything about it, because immediately they're relegated to the realm of they're out of it. And if you don't immediately applaud, you're just nothing. You're unhip. If you don't applaud immediately, it's almost totally without any kind of critical values. And you know, today a movie critic or a play critic, he's got a real problem. He's one of the things he is very afraid of is blasting something. Particularly if it's called avant-garde, he's afraid of saying it isn't very good. He's afraid of saying it's boring, because he's liable to be, again, of course, he would be hooted down. Not hooted down on the basis of it's good, but on the basis of you're a rotten critic. You're a rotten critic. And so you'll see, generally, a silence about large numbers of things which ordinarily critics would be talking about. I guess the term pop art is a good term in a sense, except that it really isn't art. It's something else again. I suppose it's the circuses that people want. You know, it's a funny thing when a guy for years his only reading is comic books. You'd be surprised how many men read comic books. Grown up, oh yeah. I saw a publisher survey recently, and it was amazing to find out the number of adults in America whose only reading matter is comic books. Yeah, only reading matter. We assume that comic books are bought by kids. Don't you bet, Dad? Go down into the subway sometime, and just look around. Just look around. And have you ever done that? And you wonder, and you'll see these people very seriously poring over the Batman meets Superman. And they're reading this thing, you know, and you can see their lips moving. And here's this guy. He's wearing a Madison Avenue suit. That's what throws you. And next to him is an attaché case. And he's saying, you rotten son. Yes, zap. And he's reading along. Well, naturally, when this guy buys a painting, what do you think he wants to buy? He wants to buy, in a giant 17-foot canvas, the cover of Batman Meets Superman, painted in exactly the same way, with the same colors, with the same balloon. I'll kill you, you bum! Zap! So he's identifying with it totally and completely. Not that it's making contact. Now, if these guys, now this is the thing that I differ with them. If these guys were making a comment on the cover of Superman Meets Batman, or if they were making a comment on the Ballantine beer label, if they were making a comment on the Campbell soup can, then I would say, fine, go, man. You're making a legitimate, if you're making a comment even about the values of America, but you're not. Not a bit of it. You're advertising this as the new true aesthetic value. It's an intriguing problem. Now, again, on the other hand, I might say that there's nobody that digs Campbell soup labels more than I do. that's true. Yeah, it's a strange thing. And yet, on the other hand, I have a terrible problem. I also dig paintings. So I suspect the day will come. You wait and see. Now, I'm making a prediction. The next big movement will be the total naturalism in art. You know, it's a funny thing about these guys. These same guys will put down guys who do what they do in another way. Because, you see, Norman Rockwell does that in another way. But for years, he was being put down by these guys. I wonder if they're putting him up now. I'm curious. Does Motherwell applaud Rockwell? I wonder. It's a good question, because they're dealing in the same thing. But I'm curious about the business of what will be. And I suspect eventually some guy will take one of his tennis shoes and he will put it on a small piece of walnut. And it'll be a worn tennis shoe. Yeah, he's worn it all summer. And underneath it, he will put a little tag. It will be called Eternity. and he will take it down. And 15 minutes later, Dad, there's going to be a one-man show at the Museum of Modern Art. There will be a tennis shoe there. He'll have his old fielder's mitt, and he'll put his old fielder's mitt on a... This time it'll be on a piece of oak, I think, would be kind of nice. And it will be hung vertically, fielder's mitt. And it will be called The Game. And then he's going to... Yes, that's true. And people will applaud the fantastic insight. And what magnificent execution. You notice that? Look how that fielder's mitt is frayed there at the bottom. And then he'll have a pair of his jockey shorts hanging. Oh yeah, all crumpled up, hanging there. And he'll spray it with a little bronze paint. And this will be mounted on, I would say, some slate, nice piece of slate there will be mounted. And under it, it will be called Procreation. And and it'll go on and on. And one man show. I could whip this show up in about 20 minutes. It's good to see though. Now, it is. It's very good to see. I'm not putting it down either, fellas. I'm just amused by it. I'm enjoying it because if there's anything that's more pop art, it's old Shep here. I mean, this is old pop art here. Old art pop. Angry call there from somebody? Oh, what? Is this a guy who was out there pasting up Rheingold labels? Yeah, it's a Rheingold man there. What's fascinating is that this art, which is truly anti-intellectual, the minute you talk about it and blast it, you are called anti-intellectual. I'm sure that the guy says, he's a slob, doesn't understand, he's anti-intellectual. No, I'm sorry, Dad, that the anti-intellectual today, the true anti-intellectual today, always masquerades as an intellectual. And so the guy who deals in that friendly old three-letter word, which is not intellectual at all, this is purely a passion. Don't confuse passions with ideas. Don't confuse with likes, with a thought, with an idea. It's just not there. And that the problem here, of course, is one where we have begun to confuse ideas with passion. And so today, sex is an intellectual concept. Forget it. If that's true, the buffaloes know about it too. And so do the grasshoppers. And I've rarely met an intellectual grasshopper. I've met a few, but I don't want to sound like I'm discriminating here, but they're really not very smart underneath it all. But they have a natural sense of rhythm. but there again, you see, and I'm sure that the minute that the anti-intellectual parades as an intellectual, the intellectual will be called anti-intellectual. Very much so. And this has always been the way, and it was this way in several other societies in the past, that the minute that an anti-intellectual concept is intellectualized, it then becomes an intellectual concept, literally does. And if you attack it, you are called anti-intellectual. This happened in several... For example, it happened when anybody attacked the Dionysian cults. The man was called anti-intellectual. Actually, he wasn't at all anti-intellectual. He was anti something else, but not anti-intellectual. That he wasn't. But this gets to be a highly complex problem. And tonight's class in aesthetics is not devoted necessarily to that problem. But and one more thing, too, that there's no question about it, that a lot of this stuff is very pleasant and it's humorous and amusing. That goes for absolutely without saying. And yet, it is not necessarily a highly intellectual achievement. To be amusing is not necessarily to be profound, not in any sense of the word. To be entertaining is not rarely involves saying anything really about the world. Many of the anti-intellectual concepts. What is probably one of the more intriguing developments along this line is the anti-intellectual novel, which by sheer technique covers up the fact that there is absolutely no idea behind the novel. And the idea, of course, is usually, if you ever take the idea out, it's very banal, like war is kind of rotten, or it's just like people get old. And so the anti-intellectual novel is against the idea of really thinking about a situation. Thinking about a situation usually means coming to a conclusion based on available evidence and past experience. So if you can forget all past experience and also forget all available evidence, then you will dig a lot of the things. Like Catch-22 is a good example of the anti-intellectual novel at its best. That the minute you forget that there was a war and that there was a Hitler and that people were being burnt in gas ovens, if you can forget all those things, then the premise of the novel is valid. Totally. Now, if you can forget somehow that the original Campbell soup can is better than any reproduction that you can possibly do of it, well, then you can accept one of the, you can accept the concept, you can accept it well. I remember a few years ago on the air, it's kind of eerie. A few years ago, I have a tape of this show where I predicted that eventually beer bottles would be art. Now, at that time, I was making a kind of a bet, you know. I never really believed, because it's hard to believe when you say things that it's going to come true. It's very difficult. And sure enough, within a year, a guy had sold and made a tremendous splash on two Ballantine beer cans mounted on bronze. That's true. Made a big thing and made a tremendous splash of this thing. Now, I don't know whether he got the idea from the show or whether it was a natural development of the final anti-intellectual statement. I don't know. But I had made a prediction one day, just in casual, making a bit, you know. I was talking about how you could do this great artwork. You could go out and you can get an old bed spring, and you could spray it, bronze. And I said, you take old bronze and spray it, and then you take a blowtorch and you heat it up all over it so it gets black, and then you mount it upright and twist it a little bit, and you call it the death of love. Well, by George, I do this thing a bit, you know, and I have the music on. By George, not more than 6 months later, I go into a big uptown gallery, and guess what is there with the sign, the death of love, under it? And it was marked sold, and I said to the guy, how much? He says, $3,500. Beautiful. I said, yeah. And I realized what you have to do is to take yourself seriously to do this. Is that you have to have a certain amount of seriousness about your triviality. Your basic triviality has to be approached as an artwork in itself. And so it's an intriguing thing. I'm sure that a lot of guys are going to yell and say, he doesn't understand. Well, I do. I know. I understand. I do appreciate. One of the more intriguing non-intellectual painters or non-intellectual artists is a man I know. I'll tell you this, a little side issue here. I know a guy who for years was a very successful soap opera writer. And He just wrote plain, ordinary soap opera, and he didn't take himself seriously. And he had a lot of fun writing it, and he made a pot full of dough, and he went along for years writing soaps. And one night, he went to the theater, very big official theater, see, and he saw this real terrible, rotten play. And the play had been running for about 8 months, and it got all kinds of great reviews. So this guy went home, and he talked it over with his wife, and he says, this is ridiculous. And so with that, he started to work, and he took one of his episodes from his soap opera and merely extended it a little bit. It was pure soap opera. It was taken right off the air. Now, even the dialogue, the situation and the characters. Now, the thing that was intriguing was, of course, that none of the critics would ever listen to this. And if they did, it would be called, it's a soap opera. What a ridiculous. It's a pap that the American housewife is listening to while she's waiting for her husband to come home. And it would be just put down. Well, he put this piece of soap opera on the stage, and believe it or not, it won every available award. This thing was a smash hit. And it was hailed as a searing psychological drama dealing with the dilemma of modern-day life with genuine 20th century people. And they had marched right off of that loudspeaker. They had come right out of that screen, carrying in one hand a can of Mr. Clean and in the other hand a can of Dream, the new pink detergent. And so he had a big laugh and he set to work writing another one. Well, he's won every award in the book. He discovered a secret in life. He discovered one of the new secrets, and that is that if you present your glop seriously, if you present your triviality with a great fanfare of trumpets, if you present your triviality with a great serious troubled look on your face, you become an important artist. And hardly anybody really looks at what you've done. And the frame is very important, believe me. And so he discovered that what had at one time been just nothing glop coming out of a loudspeaker became an important statement and commentary on life when it was surrounded by a big Broadway theater. The frame, that's all frame. If you play around down in the basement and you have a spray gun and you bronze baby shoes and stuff, that's called trivial nothing. But the minute you bronze your baby shoe, Dad, you know those bronze baby shoes they used to sell in the dime store? The minute you bronze your baby shoe and take it down and have it put on display at the Museum of Modern Art, within 15 minutes you're internationally famous. That same bronze baby shoe. Remember that. One guy takes himself seriously, the other doesn't. I wonder, my Aunt Clara, for example, she was very good at taking ball jars, you know, canning jars. And she used to take canning jars, and she would take the insides of Christmas cards. You know, the Christmas card envelopes, they have that little paper inside, that little red paper. And she used to take a wrapping paper and cut it up in little squares and paste it inside the ball jar and make like a mosaic. And then she would paint little black lines on the outside and spray it with shellac. Well, what she did was put pencils into that. That's all. And she used to give it to my Aunt Teresa all the time, who would throw them out the back door when she got them. My mother still has a couple down in the basement. Well, a couple of weeks ago, there was a very serious gallery exhibit of exactly the same thing uptown. And they ran something like, well, all the way from $75 to maybe $300 per crack. Were called, believe it or not, they were called Christmas mosaics with a ceramic touch there by Ball of Muncie, Indiana. And so time and tide and all the rest of it go. Keep your knees loose, Dad. And I'll tell you one thing. Just look around. I mean, just look around very carefully. And maybe you can dig up an old Fielder's net. And there are a couple of other things that I can suggest here offhand that might make that old ping pong paddle of yours, friend. Don't throw it out. That old worn pair of corduroy pants, don't throw it out. A little can of aluminum paint, a couple of tacks, a nice big piece of plywood, and a very important label that says, Childhood, the youth, the life, the death of an American, and you're in business. On the